He was about 10 years old. He had a 15-year-old babysitter who was a woman, and she said to him, "Do you want to smell my vulva?" So any issue you have with sex or relationships, I'm your woman.
Have you heard the name Bonnie Blue?
It was just very sad because like no one was coming to rescue them. So he'd literally wake up in the morning and want to go straight down and sniffing away. And then I came on board at Married at First Sight, like the ratings through the roof every year. And your woman is saying to you, "Hey, I want 30 minutes of foreplay." And you're thinking, "Mate, I can only do like, give you 5 minutes right now. Like, I'm super excited."
There's this like epidemic of lonely young men that aren't having sex. They're not having relationships. They're scared to communicate.
They think it's about sex, but I think it's about...
Charlene Douglas, thank you for being here. It's a massive honour. I'm very, very excited to talk to you, as I'm sure Jack is as well. We always start our podcast off the same way. So who are you and what problem do you solve?
Okay, so I'm Charlene Douglas. I'm a psychosexual therapist and I solve the problems linked to sex and relationships. So any issue you have with sex or relationships, I'm your woman.
Okay, so for someone for someone listening, let's imagine it was a typical doctor's surgery.
Okay.
What are the symptoms that make someone end up in the office with you?
Oh, this is a good question. So oftentimes the relationship is broken down. So communication is broken down. People are at a bit of a stalemate and they aren't being intimate anymore. So usually that's the point where one person will say, "Hey, let's go and speak to Charlie."
Right. Nice.
Yeah.
So it sounds like people will come to you when it's too late, or they're trying to get there because they're feeling it. What are some of the early warning signs? You know, like on a car where it flickers on, it says, "Get this checked out." What are some of those early signs?
Yeah, I think when you're arguing quite a lot, you're not resolving the issues. Obviously, if sex isn't happening and it's something that's important for you in a relationship, then that's a bit of a red flag that something needs to be addressed here. I think avoidance as well, and that can happen quite a lot in relationships where you have one or both partners that are just not talking about it. It's like the elephant in the room, but you maybe notice that you're becoming irritable about other things, like, you know, you didn't do the washing, or you didn't put the rubbish out. So I think those types of issues, you start to notice actually maybe you might need a bit of help. But so often people wait until it really has built up. They have like a big argument, someone walks out, and then it's like, let's go and see Charlene now.
Yeah, let's get Charlene in. Okay, I want to dive straight into the deep end. I want to understand attachment styles. Mm. Where do we start?
Oh, that's a big question. Okay, so when we're young, we, like, based on the relationships we have with our kind of early caregiver, we develop like an attachment style. So the ideal situation is that you have like a secure attachment style, and that is that your parents will, you know, give you the right loving, nurturing, emotional care that you need. What you'll then see with children that are securely attached is that, you know, the parent might go out the room and the child might feel a little bit like nervous, a bit anxious, but they can quite easily settle in their space. And then the parent will come back and then they'll be like, "Oh, mum and dad's back." And then they'll go back to the parent. But what we find is that there are often times where you'll have children that maybe have or develop like an avoidant attachment style. And that can happen if there's like neglect in the space. So the child then just learns, well, I just have to like do this world on my own, and no one's going to come to help me. It's quite sad to see. And I remember when I was training, seeing examples of children that had this like avoidant attachment style. It was just very sad. It was like no one was coming to rescue them. And then you have the anxiously attached, where maybe there have been times where their parents have been quite unpredictable. So sometimes the parent's there, but sometimes the parent's not. Or maybe like parents that maybe like sneak out the door, and, you know, the child doesn't know if the parent's coming back. So That's kind of a very broad example of those attachment styles. But then what can happen is that they then continue throughout our lifetime and impact our relationships, our marriages. And that's when problems can arise.
How do they present themselves then? So if you fast forward to when people are adults, I mean, I'm sure we all know and can think of examples of people that we could spot that in, or those kind of symptoms or those traits. What do they look like in a like marital or relationship behavior?
Yeah, so someone who maybe has more of a secure attachment style, they may be able to be a little bit more logical in a situation. So a partner might have behaved in a way that they felt was inappropriate. They would be able to have that conversation with their partner, sit down, talk about it, think about their point of view, the partner's point of view, and together, you know, work on a way to move forward. That's kind of the ideal situation, right? We probably are not used to that so often, but that's the ideal situation. But then you get maybe someone who's a bit more anxiously attached, and they want lots of cuddles, and they want a lot of attention, and they want to always be by your side. And they maybe they're a bit insecure sometimes when you haven't honored them in public, or you haven't showed like public displays of affection. So, you know, you sort of notice it in those types of behaviors. And then you get the kind of avoidant attachment style in relationships. Now, stereotypically speaking, men are known to sort of adopt that place. And so it'd be that classic thing of, you know, maybe in a heterosexual relationship, your partner saying, "Hey, babe, let's talk now." And, you know, oftentimes you're both smiling. So oftentimes that's a kind of like, "Oh my gosh, no, what have I done" type thing. But more than that, I suppose someone who really is avoidant, they will just do everything in their power not to have that kind of vulnerable conversation. They won't talk about it, bury their head under the sand, dismiss everything, and the list goes on.
Nice. How does that marry up with different love languages?
So love languages is really interesting. And the reason I say this is because there's no real research or sort of scientific research when it comes to love languages, although I find them really, really fascinating. I don't know if I can say there's sort of any kind of correlation between attachment styles and love languages, only because with attachment styles, there's lots of research that's gone into attachment styles. Love languages, I don't think there really has been much research. Other than, you know, the work that we do with clients, we know that it's helpful for them to understand the five love languages, particularly because the couples I work with, some of the biggest arguments that they have is, "I don't feel loved by my partner." And so if you don't feel loved by your partner because they're not showing you love in a way that you show love, then it's like, well, maybe understand that maybe they show love in a different way. So again, I'm going to be very stereotypical here and say that, let's say for women, physical touch is really important. It might be for their husbands, the acts of service, you know, so they will put the mirror up on the wall, or they will make sure the petrol's in the car because they know that their partner's got a long journey the next day. And for women, they can sometimes miss that loving sign because they're like, "But you didn't hug me," you know, and it's important to communicate so you're both aware, I think, of each other's love languages.
Interesting. What could you break those down for them, those love languages? What?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so this is the test now. So gifts, so that'll be your normal flowers, chocolates, whatever it may be. Acts of service, which is what I've just described, putting a mirror up on the wall, doing someone's garden or whatever it may be. We've got words of affirmation, so compliments, also things like, you know, like maybe writing on a post-it note, like, "I love you," or "You've got this, babe." You know, maybe sticking that in your partner's folder or briefcase when they go to work or something like that. You know, little things like that. You know, words of affirmation. What else have we got? Physical touch. And of course, that's physical touch. Mm-hmm. I think what's really important to say about physical touch, though, is that if your love language is physical touch, it's important to understand the context of physical touch for you. Because this has gone really wrong for a lot of couples, where the guy will hear that the woman's like love language is physical touch, and he will decide to cuddle her when she is focused on cooking or something like that. Or he might touch places that she's not ready to be touched at a time when she's concentrating on something at work, an eat work email or something like that. So time and context is really key. And so it's important to have those conversations. Which ones have I missed? I've done, so words of affirmation, gifts, physical touch, acts of service. I feel like there's a fifth one. I can't remember off the top of my head.
We'll put it in the...
Yeah.
Find there's what, a what, one. What the button was.
Yes.
So then do they...
Quality time.
Quality time.
That's it, quality time.
As in time together, date night.
Yes, but also quality time is really important as well to discuss and to have that conversation about, because it looks different for different people. So for some people, being in the same car together, dropping the kids off to school, is we're together. For other people, it's putting your phone away, let's watch Netflix, let's really spend time together. And so that can also cause a lot of arguments if you think that, you know, we've had quality time, when your partner's like, no, your phone was out and, you know, you were chatting to your friend as well. And for some partners, they were like, but you, we were next to each other.
So if I'm, let's say I'm an avoidant and my love language is acts of service, am I looking for someone who's avoidant and acts of service, or do I have to find something that's totally different so that they kind of gel together?
So I think what happens, so in terms of what you need to look for, I think unconsciously we gravitate towards people for various reasons. So research has shown that there are times where if you have had like maybe some kind of childhood trauma, that you might try to kind of repair those wounds by choosing someone that may be similar to the perpetrator, let's say. So a very basic example of this might be if you had, I don't know, a mother that was really, really controlling and never listened to you, you might find that your wife is quite controlling and you're constantly getting into arguments because you're desperately trying to correct what you weren't able to do when you were younger. But you'll be sort of banging your head against the wall because it's like there's something unconscious going on there. So I think it's not so clear cut to say kind of who you should be with. In an ideal world, we would be, you know, we'd have a secure attachment and our partner would have a secure attachment, right? And you'd be able to have adult conversations. You'd be able to give each other the space when you need it. All of that would be the ideal situation. But I think that the more emotionally safe you feel with a partner, which usually happens over time, the more the sorts of the secure elements of you can come out, so you do feel connected and you don't always then feel so triggered.
That was brilliant. So we're obsessed with therapy techniques and how we use them in everyday life and use them. I keep thinking about like the avoidant. Okay, so you've got an avoidant that comes into your studio, your office, they lay down on the shaylong and then you're having a conversation with somebody that's probably avoidant. How are you getting them to open up and be honest and give you that information?
Yeah, so I, as well as being a psychosexual therapist, I'm also a psychodynamic counsellor, and that's where the psychodynamic element comes in. So for me, what I'd be looking to do, now I feel like I'm telling you all the tricks.
give it all. Yeah,
so any avoidant person listening will be like, I know what you're doing. But the key is kind of build like a what we call a therapeutic alliance, so that kind of real strong relationship so that they feel safe with you. They don't feel like you're sort of pushing them into a corner, trying to get an answer from them, because that's going to kind of push them into the corner a lot more. What I would do, my choice of language might be a bit different. So I'd help them to understand that, you know, we're in this together. You know, let's explore this together. Let's unpack this together. You know, I wonder how that felt for you. Sometimes when you're avoidant, you might struggle to find the words to express the feeling. And so it might be them expressing a story and me saying, oh, that sounds quite sad. And in their mind, they may never have really acknowledged that it was sadness. But the more that sort of said to them, the more they have the space to have a think about it. Psychodynamic counselling is, I think, fantastic, but it's not for everyone, because part of the work is allowing for silence. And not everyone is okay with that. We're in a world or a society where it's all about kind of instant, you know, you need an answer straight away, which is probably why CBT works so well. Although in saying that, research has shown that a lot of people then kind of sort of head over to other types of therapy once they've done CBT, because it's quite short term and sometimes people want to go a bit deeper. But I think with psychodynamic counselling, it is important. It is long term. You allow for silences, you allow for a relationship to be built. And when people feel emotionally safe, that's when you usually get the best out of them.
So then a lot of relationships, I would say, will kind of fall down because of that lack of communication, that they're not going in having conversations with therapists. It's getting to a point where it's too late and it's blowing up and they're leaving it. So what can people do when they're in relationships to communicate more effectively?
Again, big question.
Sorry, Charlene, I'm known for those.
No, I really love these questions. So I think the first thing is that you have to acknowledge that there's a problem. And so what usually happens is that it takes a while before people realise that we really have a problem when it comes to communicating. So a lot of the couples that I work with, the very first thing that they will say to me is, Charlene, I have an issue with my partner in the bedroom, so linked to sex, but my actual relationship is fine. So they're like, you don't need to kind of delve into the relationship part. It's just a sex, it's just in the bedroom. And I would always say that it's never just in the bedroom. This has started in the relationship. You haven't felt respected. You haven't felt valued. Your voice hasn't been heard. You have felt emasculated. Something is going on here that is playing out in the bedroom, like 100%. So in terms of helping them to communicate, I suppose therapy in itself, obviously talking therapy in itself is powerful because you're teaching people how to communicate. So the questions that I would ask my clients teaches them how communication actually works. And I suppose I'm known to ask the questions that people avoid as well. And you'll see that on, I suppose, Married at First Sight, but also in my practice that, you know, if someone's saying something to me like, you know, yeah, like the sex is great, I'll say, what is it about the sex that's great? Right?
Good question.
Right. And when they say, well, this is really, really lovely, I'll say, well, tell me a time when something wasn't so good. Because oftentimes what can happen, people just focus on the, yeah, it's great, we had a good time. And I'm like, So if it was so great, tell me the reason that you're not going back to it. Like, what's going on there?
Mm.
And so I suppose what I'm saying is that in terms of teaching people how to communicate through the therapy, they kind of learn some of those skills. In saying that, there are tools that you can give people as well. So helping people to understand the importance of really actively listening to your partner. So often what happens is you just wait for your partner to finish talking so you can just say you're
yeah.
Like, you're just, you know, and if you really want to show that, you know, I'm being mature here, you're like, okay, just finish. In your head you're thinking, just finish, and then you're going to give it to them with your evidence. But what can happen in that space is that you're both doing the same thing.
Mm.
And so no one's really listening to each other. So a lot of the work that we do in therapy is teaching people how to actively listen, because that's really important.
When you said that, then I think about one thing my wife, and I think lots of people's wives, don't like, is when you go straight into that kind of like fixer mode straight away. So problem is presented and it's like, oh, have you ever tried doing this before? And before you know it, you've like made it so much worse. And having that space to go, oh, that sounds really frustrating or annoying, or I could see why that would bother you,
yeah,
tends to land a bit better. Do you know why that is, why it's so much more frustrating to jump straight into, I want to fix this for you?
Well, everyone's different, right? So there's some people where that works really well. They're looking for a solution. But I think sometimes people just want to know that you're in it with them, mm-hmm. that you're validating their feelings, their emotions, their thoughts. What can be helpful is to say, is there anything that you'd like me to do to help? You know, so that they have a choice, because otherwise it could indirectly sound like you're saying to them, wow, your problem's really bad. Like, how could you not have thought of this? I'm giving you a solution. Like, yeah, right? Yeah. It could sound a bit like that. And if you're in that space where you're feeling really overwhelmed anyway, and you're maybe not feeling that great, you're not feeling very powerful, the partner that's over your shoulder and says to you, well, all you have to do is, and you know what, with all due respect to men, and we absolutely love men, sometimes the male tone of voice can, for some, be a bit patronizing, right?
Can't it, Jack?
Yes, it can, Zach. Mansplaining.
Right, the mansplaining. And sometimes it could be like, all you need to do is, did you not think about doing?
Yeah.
And you know, some of those choice of words or that tone can just trigger someone.
Yeah, I'm with you. One of the other things that you mentioned that I wanted to kind of jump back to is, so at the start of relationships, it can feel like you're both very sexually compatible.
Yeah.
And then flash forward past kind of honeymoon phase, it's kind of, that's what you're actually like as a sexual partnership.
Mm.
Why is that? Why are you so sexually compatible at the start? And then you're kind of, oh, actually, we're really like 6 months down the line. That's what we're both like as a default setting.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things there. So I think that when we first get into relationships, we don't really show up fully as our authentic self, right? So you're not, you know, all your flaws, you're doing your best to kind of keep them right at the back. If you're an impatient person, you're desperately trying to be patient. If you're a bit selfish, you're desperately trying to be selfless. Like, you know, that is just natural. And then there comes a point, usually I say around the 3 month point, where you can't hold on to that lies anymore. Yeah, yeah. And your personality comes out. And that's not to say, actually, I say lies as a joke, but you know, there are there's different parts of our characters, right? Mm-hmm. So there are parts of us where we feel really overwhelmed and we don't know what to do with it. But there are times we can feel maybe overwhelmed and we know exactly what we need to do. So, but I think when you first meet someone, you show them all the good sides, right? Also, when it comes to sex and intimacy, it's all very new when you first meet somebody. So it's very unpredictable. It's very new. Oftentimes you don't live together. So there's that excitement of, oh, I get to see my partner and all the kind of imaginations, all the excitement around that. We also know that desire is created when there's distance as well. So when there's a little bit of distance and you're like, oh, we're going to come back together, that could be exciting. But if you like living together, you're seeing the good and the bad of your partner. You've just gone to a toilet and they've just come out, right? Or you've seen underwear that didn't look as sexy as it did when you first met them. All those things kind of contribute to this sort of shift in the relationship. And I think it's in those moments that people try so desperately to just hold on to what they had when they first started, as opposed to acknowledging, no, I need to be intentional daily to keep this relationship alive. In the same way you would, like, you know, when you're at work, right? So you go to work, you don't just sort of stay stagnant in your role and, you know, not learn how to do things any better or any differently. You have team meetings, you have one-to-ones, you do all that you can to be better. And then usually you'll be promoted. That's kind of the idea, right? But with relationships, I think people just sort of stop. They're like, well, we love each other and there was sexual attraction. We've got kids now and we've got a house, so it's okay. But actually, you've got to still keep putting the work in to kind of keep it new, keep it alive, keep it fun. And that's where I think people sort of fall down because they don't always do that.
So what are the, I guess, what's the prescription, Charlene? What should people be doing to fix that, to go in and be like, right, this is going to be the thing that blows everyone's socks off and gets us there?
Yeah, I think you have to do the work on yourself. I think so for so many people, they have maybe childhood trauma, or when I say childhood trauma, I don't always mean like the trauma as we know it in terms of those big things. You know, even some of the kind of what we call the small T traumas, you know, maybe parents are divorced and we just felt a bit abandoned, even though we maybe saw our dads at the weekend. You know, all of those kind of experiences can impact how we show up in a relationship. And so it is our responsibility to be the best version of ourselves in the relationship and to kind of continue to work on that. And particularly in this country, it's not necessarily the done thing. And there's still a lot of stigma around therapy. I think the great thing with like social media, we've got lots of great podcasts, calls like this. We've got relationship podcasts, we've got sex podcasts. So you can learn if you want to, but not everyone does. So I think if you want to go into a relationship and you want to make it work, you've got to do the work on yourself. Like, that is key. But you've also got to learn how to communicate and compromise. And I think if you can't do that, then you'll be coming to see me.
send them in. So then it gets me thinking, and we've been talking about this a lot recently, like on podcasts and off podcast, there's this like epidemic of lonely young men that aren't having sex, they're not having relationships, they're scared to communicate. So I guess I'd love to get your take on it, and then I'd like maybe like to touch on the first dates, how you should be approaching dating, relationships, things like that.
What's the question? What's the first question?
I'm asking two. I didn't want to ask a big one.
That's all right.
I would like to get your take on what's going on at the moment generationally with kind of young men and the dating scene.
Yeah. I think when I think about some of the young men that I've spoken to that have sort of come to my practice, what they have said is that they felt quite confused in terms of what's expected of them in a relationship. So I think if you kind of rewind to, like, I don't know, the 1950s, it felt probably really clear what the roles were. And, you know, if I think about, say, heterosexual relationships, it, you know, back at, actually, I'll say the 1950s, I saw an advert in the 1980s advert, and it was so stereotypical. It was like the woman was cooking dinner and all the kids came running around the table, and then the husband came in from work and he like took his boots off, and it was so stereotypical. But I think, and I'm not saying that we need to go back to that, because I think we definitely need to not go back to that, but it felt like the roles were quite clearly established. I think now for a lot of young guys, they sort of feel like they're not sure what to do. Like, should they offer a bit of chivalry in the relationship, or should they hold on to the feminist approach that I think a lot of women have? And rightly so. You know, do they pay for a date or not? Do they go half-half? Like, do they let the partner pay? I think there's a lot of confusion, I think, around what the done thing is or what the right thing is. But I think that, you know, if you can meet somebody that you can have a really open conversation with about their expectations in the relationship and your expectations, and together agree on what you both want moving forward, then I think it can be really powerful.
Is there, just talking about that then, is there anything that happens in early life that typically leads someone to be a bit more promiscuous when they do get sexually active? Are there any links?
Yes. It's interesting, though, the word promiscuous, because I think years ago, that word was probably used a lot more. Mm-hmm. I think now it's probably seen more, particularly with women, that women are feeling more liberated.
Yes.
Or the fact that the word is sometimes associated with women being promiscuous, but for men, it's like just having a good time,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I think when you say the word promiscuous, that's the first thing that came to my mind. I think, I mean, there's a whole host of factors. I think that if you've had someone that in childhood hasn't been allowed to ask about sex, about intimacy, then you might find that when they hit that adult 18 or 16 in terms of the legal age of consent, that they might really want to explore. You know, it's like kind of the floodgates have opened. It's like, yes, I get to go out and enjoy this. I think the thing is, I think if you are someone that loves a lot of sex, there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. But I think you have to ask yourself, what purpose does it serve? If it serves like a healthy purpose, then absolutely great. Mm-hmm. It makes you, you know, it's pleasure, a bit of fun, helps you to connect with people, de-stresses you, like, go for it. But I think some of the people that come into my practice where they're having maybe lots of sex with lots of different people, it's masking something a bit deeper, you know, a bit of some pain there. Maybe they're trying to avoid real intimacy because, you know, when you're having casual sex, it's not oftentimes very intimate, is it? It's just like wham, bam, thank you, ma'am kind of thing, right? And that was pleasurable, that was great. But when we're talking about an intimate relationship where, you know, you're discussing your vulnerabilities, you're really connecting with somebody, you know, you'll get people that can orgasm at the same time, you know, where they're so in tune with each other. For some people, that's quite a fearful experience, getting too close to someone. Mm. So as a result, they then just maybe have lots of sex. So I feel like I'm not sure if I've completely answered your question.
No, you have.
It feels like there's just lots of different reasons why people might choose to have lots of sexual partners.
I was actually more so thinking from I know and have known a lot of men who almost voraciously pursue a female. And then as soon as they've had sex, it's like, I'm totally over it. I'm not interested anymore.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what would lead someone to kind of want to do that and repeat that over and over and over again.
It could be a number of things. I mean, it could be what we've just described there around a fear of real intimacy. Sometimes, and some of the men that I've worked with, when they were younger, they were told they weren't good enough. They weren't chosen by the girls. So now it's like there's this quest to prove to themselves constantly that I'm good enough, I can get the girl. And once they've got the girl, they're not interested anymore. And that I see quite a lot in my practice, actually, where some men are just like, I actually do want to settle down. I just can't connect with a woman. I just love the chase, that adrenaline, because it's a bit of an adrenaline rush, isn't it? It's like, can I get her? Can I get her? Yes, I have. Oh, great. Okay. Can I get another one? But then there's a loneliness in that as well, because we are designed to be in relationships. So if you can never really connect with a partner, that will catch up with you eventually.
Mm-hmm. So what are some examples of that healthy, you were talking about it before, but like that healthy sexual relationship, maybe for men more so, but what is an example of what does that look like where it's not on the line?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we're talking about kind of having a number of partners. So just because you have a number of partners, it doesn't mean necessarily that there's anything unhealthy going on for you. But I think it's about understanding yourself, understanding your desires, your needs, your wants, making sure that you're not using sex to mask something that you're lacking in life or within yourself. I think that if you are clear of the reasons that you're doing it, there's absolutely no reason that you can't go out and have fun with lots of different people and enjoy yourself. Of course, consent is really important. Boundaries are important. So making sure that the person that you're having sex with consents. and that you're both enjoying it. If you're, you know, two adults or two or more adults, because it doesn't always have to be two, you know, if you're enjoying yourself, there's boundaries in place and there's consent, then happy days.
Mm. And when people come to see you, what are they getting wrong when it comes to pleasure?
Overthinking it, I would say. They're overthinking it. It's kind of like, oh, this is what I should be feeling now, as opposed to allowing their body just to feel it. I think for so many of us, we've been taught that sex is like a performance more than an experience.
Mm.
And so if you think about a performance, like think about, so I went to watch Tina Turner, the musical, right? And I was at the front and I could kind of feel the tension of the actors and actresses behind the curtain sort of thing, right? Or at least that's what I thought. And you can just imagine the nerves that they're experiencing. And then all of a sudden the curtains open and then everyone is watching them and they have to perform. Sometimes for some people, that's what sex can feel like, where it's like, okay, I've got to perform right now. And when you're in that space, then it takes away from pleasure and really enjoying it. I think the people that get the most out of sex are people where they know what they like, they know what turns them on, but they're with a partner that they feel safe with, safe to just be themselves. And what I mean by that is that if they accidentally fart, then that's okay, you know, like, or if there is something that goes wrong, they need to drop off the bed or whatever it may be, it could be laughed, you know, you can laugh with your partner and it's all okay, as opposed to a partner that's like, oh, what are you doing that for? Oh my gosh, you fart, that's awful. Like, you know, those types of things. Now, I'm not saying, you know, smelling the fart isn't awful, but it's like, you know, you want to be in a safe environment with your partner that you can just laugh about it or just be silly about it, open the windows, whatever, but not that you're shaming the person. Mm. And I think that in order to create pleasure, you need to feel physically and emotionally safe with somebody.
Nice. That leads, I think, nicely onto... But I want to ask you, it's another big question. Are you prepared?
Hold the table.
Yeah.
How does someone gain a fetish? How does that come about?
This is interesting. I was talking about this yesterday, as you do, as a sex therapist with somebody. And I think what's interesting about this is that there are some researchers that have said it has nothing to do with like childhood traumas or anything like that. And of course, you'll always get other researchers that say it has everything to do with some kind of trauma that you've experienced in your younger life or over, you know, throughout your life, that now you're trying to take control over the situation. I think probably both are right, you know, for different people. I can give you an example of a fetish. Are you ready for this one?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So listeners, be prepared. So there was a guy who was into smelling knickers and smelling the vulva of their partner, but they needed their partner not to have washed.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
How long?
That's not a big question.
So I think for a considerable amount of time. So he would say that he wanted to know how much he could kind of really deal with. So he would want the woman to, you know, if it's like maybe a couple of days, he'd be great, like great. Or if maybe she'd gone to the gym and she was really sweaty, he's like, no, don't shower. I remember for her, this was super strange. Because oftentimes, you know, I suppose as a woman, you do feel maybe self-conscious, you know, around like making sure I smell okay, mm-hmm. right? But she said that she started to get on board with it and actually started to find it quite a turn on. So he'd literally wake up in the morning and want to go straight down in between the, you know, in a vulva, playing around, and she could just hear him sniffing away. And the more he did that, the more he was becoming erect, the more turned on he was. Now, where has that come from? As soon as I heard him talk about this, I was super curious and I was thinking, what's this about? Like, where did this all start? The sad thing is it started, I think, with something that was traumatic. But for him, he was like, I don't know, it wasn't a big deal. So when he was, I think he was about 10 years old, he had a 15-year-old babysitter who was a woman. And she said to him, do you want to smell my vulva? Mm. Now, we now know that that's actually very abusive.
Mm.
But in his mind, he was like, oh, this is cool. I told all my friends, like, this, she was like an older lady. And like, you know, but we know that, you know, both the 15-year-old girl that is asking him to do this, there was probably something going on for her that she even had the idea that that would be something that a young boy would do, and for him as well. But then what happened is that he started to get really used to doing it and enjoyed it and noticed that it was becoming sexually arousing for him as well. And that's where it started. So now any woman that he chooses, so he's not with this woman anymore, any woman that he chooses to be with moving forward, he says it's important that they are open to having their vulva sniffed.
Wow. Isn't that fascinating how some of the things that are traumatic kind of link into different chemical receptors?
Mm.
So like that, because you think of something traumatic that happened could impact your relationship where you're like, oh, actually, turn all the lights off. Like, I feel so vulnerable now, like turn the lights off.
Yeah.
But then what you're saying there, even though that's traumatic, must have linked into a different receptor. So it's almost like that release, I don't know, dopamine or whatever it may be. But it's still just as traumatic as the turn the lights off person.
Absolutely. I think for him, and it took him a while to really understand that actually what he was explaining to me was actually a traumatic experience that had happened to him in his childhood. But I think for him, he didn't have a great relationship with his parents. So for him, this felt quite intimate. It felt quite close. And from a child's point of view that doesn't know any better, you can understand maybe why that's the conclusion that they would come to. But then it set something off in him that to be close to somebody, to be really intimate, like this is what you do. And then obviously there was a physiological response to that in that he was becoming erect from it. And then at that point that the woman was also on board with it too, because I think there was something quite taboo about it. So,
fascinating. So there's... So that trauma response sounds like it was obviously like, I think the thing with trauma that a lot of people think of it as like, how do I fix the trauma or how do I get rid of it or whatever, but where that sounds like I'm actually quite happy with the trauma response. I'm sure there are people listening to this that are feeling that their fetishes or their things that they find pleasure from are probably quite shameful. There's this guilt attached to it. How do you help people navigate that conversation if there is that shame?
Well, I think if there's shame attached to it, it is about understanding what, I suppose, just unpacking it, you know, just kind of, because I think that the whole thing around shame is that you're not able to kind of apply logic to the situation. So the therapist's role is kind of help you to apply logic to it over a period of time, so that the messages that you're sending to yourself that I should be ashamed is a bit different, you know, instead of I should be ashamed, it's like this situation happened to me, you know, I was a young person, I didn't have the control over the situation. We also know that, you know, a young person doesn't have the ability to consent to anything, that the brain isn't fully developed then either, so they don't have the life experience, they don't have the logic that we do as adults. So I think the more you work with a client that is experiencing shame, it can take some time, but usually they get to a point where they can acknowledge that actually this situation happened to me. And then sometimes you'll find people that will like maybe create a charity or nice. Do something very positive that helps them to feel more empowered, and then they can help other people. And that can help with healing when it comes to trauma as well.
I like that. That's really nice. And then I feel like all the questions I'm going to chuck at you, I've got a really big one for you.
okay.
It's really big. All right. Okay. What I have to ask this, because obviously we've both got partners, what do men get wrong when it comes to women and sexual relations?
Everything. Okay, this is a really good question. I'm really glad that you've asked this question, actually, because I think for men it can be difficult to take the feedback on from your partner about what pleases them and what does it for them. Particularly because we live in a society where we're told that as a man, you should know what you're doing. You should be always up for sex. You should always be hard and erect. You should ejaculate after X number of minutes. And if you take too long to ejaculate, what's going on? If you ejaculate too quickly, what's going on? So there's a lot of pressure on men. So I think the message is always that as men, that you should know what you're doing. Mm. So I think if you have a partner that's saying to you, look, I like to be touched in this way, or, you know, can we introduce sex toys? Now, that is very controversial, because men and sex toys that are designed with women in mind is not always the greatest match. Sometimes men feel like they're a bit redundant and, you know, they're not needed. I mean, sometimes women probably contribute to helping them to feel like that by kind of just sort of sitting in the corner with their sex toy. But I think ultimately what you want to do to have a healthy sexual relationship is to be open to feedback. And I think sometimes that could be difficult for guys. I think also, and it's funny because I was having this conversation yesterday, I think for a lot of men, they think about sex, they dream about sex, they wonder about sex probably every day. So when their partner has finally said yes to sex, the excitement is like through the roof, that they're actually seeing the naked body, the woman that said yes, the green light is on. It's like, yes, yes, yes. And so naturally the body gets really, really excited. So then your woman is saying to you, hey, I want 30 minutes of foreplay. And you're thinking, mate, I can only do like, give you 5 minutes right now. Like, I'm super excited. And, you know, and there's nothing, shameful about the fact that for a lot of guys that they like the intercourse, like that feels nice for them. But it's just that for women, it's not like it doesn't feel nice, but it feels better when their body has really experienced that sexual charge. And yeah, I mean, there's been so many stories of guys that have, where you can just feel the guy's getting bored. they're just waiting for you to say, okay, you can penetrate now. Like, yeah, you know, that's usually what happens. But, you know, learn about foreplay, learn to be a bit intentional with your touch, introduce a bit of tease. You know, I think sometimes guys forget all that good stuff.
I'm going to ask you to give me some therapy now.
Okay.
So I've got 4 children. Mm-hmm. So I've spent a lot of my relationship with my partner without her being in a hormone cycle.
Okay.
And getting back used to that, I've been like, oh my God, she really loves me this week. And then the next week I'm like, oh, is she going to leave me? What's going on? Yeah. And then we're good at having kind of open communication and having a laugh about it.
Yeah.
But is there advice that you would give me for how to navigate that hormone cycle and kind of be a better partner throughout that?
Yeah, that's a tricky one, isn't it? Because I think sometimes as a woman, when you're feeling hormonal, sometimes you're not even really aware of it. Like it's hard to know, like, am I feeling hormonal or is he just getting on my nerves? Like, you know, it's hard to work out which one it is.
Probably both.
Yeah. Right. So it's difficult. But I think the best that you can do is ask what she needs in any given moment. And if it's space, then allow her that space. If it's a hug or if it's a cuddle or if it's a conversation, even like a cup of tea. I think oftentimes what can happen is that guys, as we said a little bit earlier, want to fix a situation. And if you're feeling really emotional, you're not in a space where anything's feeling logical for you. You know, it's not logical when you're feeling really overly emotional. Something's been triggered. And so what can be helpful is your partner saying, what do you need right now?
Weekly, daily, hourly.
I think when you notice that your partner's in a space that you're not sure what's going on there.
Yeah.
I think the longer you're with a partner, the more you kind of know, okay, like, you know, her period's due soon, for example, and this is normally a time when she behaves X, Y, Z. And you might learn then kind of what she needs in that moment. But I think if there's ever a time where you're feeling like, oh, what's going on for you here? I think to sort of say, you know, is there anything that you'd like me to do to help you right now? I think don't guess, because that's when it can go.
That's my problem. Guess and I get tough. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I think asking what she needs in any given moment, I think, is always really helpful. If the response you're getting isn't a helpful response, then I would say maybe just give her some space.
Okay. I'm going to hit you with a segue now. Both of you are going to be amazed by this.
Wow. Tune in. You ready for a segue?
One thing that does bring us together, no matter what part of the hormone cycle we're in,
yeah,
is watching Married at First Sight together.
Yay. Married at First
See
Sight.
How I did that?
That was, mate, can I shake your
hand? Yeah, you can.
That was
beautiful. Let go.
That was really right, good. Wasn't
it? Love that. Love that.
So how did you get involved?
Okay, so I would love to say that this story was really super exciting.
Okay.
So one of the producers contacted me to be on the sex clinic in 2019. So the sex clinic was on E4, and it came out, it was on a good few years before lockdown, but my series came out on literally, I think, like March 2020 of the day. So I started there. And I suppose when you work with Channel 4, they know how you work. It's probably maybe easier to kind of get other roles Or maybe I'm just saying that, and actually maybe I was just fantastic. And they just
I'm sure you were.
But yeah, so I just then randomly got a phone call, and they said that it's a really great show. We're changing the format because Married at First Sight, there was like an older format that some people describe it as the boring version, but I wouldn't say the boring version. I think it wasn't as maybe as entertaining as Kyra's. I'm just conscious that Paul Brunson was on both. He was the boring one. And the, like,
Paul was always the, great, though.
Yeah, absolutely, across the board. But yeah, the series that I started on 2021, that was when the format had changed. And so they were like, yeah, this is really great series. Like, you know, Paul and Mel are on it. So Mel's from the Australian version, and Paul was doing Celebs Go Dating, and he's done lots of other things as well. And yeah, and then I came on board as a sex and relationship therapist. And yeah, it's just gone from strength to strength. Like, the ratings are, like, they go through the roof. Every year it gets better and better. It does feel like there's the pressure, though, because every year it gets better and better. So you're just like, wow, how do we take it to the next level? And we managed to somehow do it. So yeah, it's an amazing show to be a part of.
We love it. And I think me and Zach started in the same way. It was a case of our partners saying, we're watching Married at First Sight. And I go, oh, well, I'll go and fix a car or something.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And then the head's popping around the door. I'm like, what are they doing? Wait a minute. God, that's good.
Yeah.
So I guess as you've met so many people that have been through the experiment, and I love that they talk about it so openly as it's an experiment. It doesn't necessarily mean it will work. You will find love. We know that some people have gone on, and I'm sure that you could give us some examples. As an experiment, do you think that it can work, that people can be put together and it can just, from there, that can give love?
I mean, we've proven that we have been able to do that, and that has worked. I think, you know, we do the first part, right, in terms of putting people together. Then they have to do the hard work, and that is listening and listening to the feedback. That is stepping out of their comfort zone. That is doing things differently from how they've ever done it in the past. Not everything, but certain things that maybe weren't so great. And some people are committed to that. Some people are not. And also, for some people, the spark is really important, and that they hold on to that throughout the whole experiment.
Mm.
It's like the spark wasn't there. And it's like, well, could you give the space for the spark to potentially grow? Because we know in real life that has happened for a lot of people. And some people do that, and some people don't on the show.
We're nicely diplomatic.
Yeah. When I typically hear people say the spark isn't working, it feels like, and this might not be true, but it feels like there's not a sexual attraction.
Mm.
Is that typically the case when people say the spark isn't working?
I think for some people, that's what they're talking about. But I think it's interesting, this word spark. Mm. Sometimes it's hard to really, like, understand or explain what it really is. But oftentimes we've all experienced it where it may or may not make sense, but there's just a connection that you have to somebody, and you just click, you just connect, it just works. And there are other people where, you know, you just straight away just feel like there's just something not right here. Even if that person is, like, absolutely attractive, full of life, you're just not feeling that connection. And I think on Married at First Sight, a lot of the couples want to feel that straight away. They want to be at the wedding, you know, in at the church or wherever it is, and they want to see their partner. They just want to see all those, like, whatever happens when you have that spark. What is it? Flowers and
fireworks,
all that kind of stuff. They want to feel that. And I think also as well, we've come from a world where we've all watched those children's programs. We've all watched those programs in our childhood where it's like, yeah, romantic stories where, you know, you, like Romeo and Juliet, you know, where you look at each other and you fall madly in love and you have children and it's like happy ever after. And that's happened with some of our couples, like Adam and Taya, who were in our first season. They officially got married afterwards, and now they're on their second baby.
Wow.
So there have been some really great success stories with Married at First Sight.
I've spotted something. You can tell me if I'm onto something here or not.
Okay.
Detective over here.
Yeah.
So when people get married,
yeah,
at first sight,
yep.
Yeah,
love it,
thank you,
and it's very passionate straight away, and the honeymoon's very passionate. It's very, like, all over each other, super passionate,
yeah.
Boundaries are straight down, you know, etc. They seem to be the ones that maybe don't do as well long term in the experiment, whereas the ones who kind of slow burn have to overcome a few bits at the start, And then a few weeks in, they kind of have that more tighter bond, seem to do much better. Do you want to hire me now?
We need to pull up a fourth chair. Not married at first sight.
Am I onto anything?
I think so. You're right. I think that in my experience over the last 4 years, you're right. There have been quite a few couples where that sexual spark has been there straight away, and they'll make it known that they were like at it like rabbits and all that kind of stuff. They'll be very open about that. But then when conflict knocks at their door, they can't really resolve it. They go back into old patterns of behavior. They withdraw, they shout, they scream, they go into that avoidance space. They slam the door. They want to go to another apartment for the night. I mean, that happens a lot. That happens so much where they have an argument and they're like, I'm fed up with you. And then they want to go in another apartment to sleep overnight, which is fine. Because if you're feeling really overwhelmed, that's great. But in real life, when you're married, we know that that's not worth the possibility. You have to still share the same bed. And the most you can do is just make sure your partner's leg isn't touching you. Even that is annoying for you, right? But yeah, with married at first sight, I do think that you're right. That if you, I think the couples that have worked have been the couples where they've fancied each other. They've had a great time, but it's kind of a bit slow. Yeah. And then it's really built up. So then when conflict comes to their door, it's just not so explosive. They can work through it. They can take the feedback and then they can move on. Those that have the passionate sex at the beginning are just as passionate in the conflict. Yeah. And they then can't always resolve it.
Mm. So you heard it at first, guys. I was...
Well done. Add it to your LinkedIn profile.
Yes.
The other thing that's probably more of an obvious observation, I think anyone could see, is when you have the sofa sessions, the weekly...
Commitment ceremony.
Mm-hmm. It feels like those people who it's, I'm here to be right, there's an argument or a dispute here, but actually I'm here to be right. Those ones never do well.
Yeah.
Unless you can get them to a point where it's like, it's kind of more about mutual agreement. So how much do you think communication style of someone coming in and being like, I just have to be right, gets in the way of even having any connection that's long-term?
I think you have to be in a space where you're more committed to resolving a situation with your partner more than being right. And of course, as a couples therapist as well, I see that quite often. So what will happen is you'll have a couple that've had an argument and they cannot wait to see Charlene. And they have got, both of them got like their evidence, lists of evidence of things that they need to tell Charlene because they desperately want me to be on their side. And I remember one couple where the woman was like, yeah, and he shouted in my face. And then she just stopped waiting for me to wait for my reaction. And, you know, maybe I did give her the reaction she needed, but it's that, isn't it? It's like kind of going to mummy to tell, you know. And I think that we see that on Married at First Sight as well, that they often say at like the dinner parties, you'll hear them say, we can't wait to go to the commitment ceremony and talk to the experts about this. But that's because in their mind, they are right and their partner's wrong.
Mm. So take us behind the scenes. So I'm really intrigued. How much pre the show, when it comes to the couples and the pairing, what does that actually look like in reality? How much involvement do you have?
So I feel like that question, it comes up a lot and it feels like the sort of KFC Colonel Sanders, you know, like, you know, what is the recipe? Yeah. So we give different answers depending on which platform we're on. So I think what I will say is this. So we obviously match them, right? But we have to make sure, or at least the producers have to make sure that people are okay to be on TV, right? So in terms of background checks need to be done. So if we think a couple can work really well, but the background checks have shown that actually there's something a bit shady here that isn't great for TV, then they won't be on the show. So, you know, there's safeguarding, there's legal teams, there's lots of people involved to make sure we get the right people. But ultimately, it's Paul, Mel and I that are kind of having those discussions and working out who we think will be the best match.
So 20 people on the table, 10 men, 10 women. What are you... Because it feels like one direction. Do you know what I mean? Like, oh, we'd look good with that person. Like, what are you looking for to say that's a match?
Yeah. Well, let's take it back. We get lots of applications in thousands of applications. So they have to be sort of whittled down as well. We have a psychologist that isn't an on-air psychologist, as it were. So she's sort of behind the scenes. So she will do like narcissism tests and attachment styles and things like that. yeah, all those kind of like self, like all those kind of assessments, self-assessments, their anxiety levels, etc., just to make sure they are in a good, healthy space to be on TV, because the whole process is, let's call it a psychological journey, right? So I think sometimes people think like, hey, I could just meet my partner and go on TV and be famous. But actually, we take people through their paces. You know, there's intimacy tasks that they have to do. There's like deep level conversations that we have with them. We challenge them. They do home stays. They do partner swaps. There's lots of spaces where you could be tempted, you know, by another partner, or where you could go, you go home to your parents and your parents are like, no, I don't like him, you know. So there's real, it's quite a journey. So we need to make sure that people are resilient enough to go through that whole process. But you're right, in terms of all the pictures on the table, trying to work out who's matched with who, my areas around sexual compatibility. So I would be looking at, I suppose, how open people are to talk about sex. It doesn't mean that if one person is not really interested in sex and the other person is, that they're not a match, because there might be other factors. There might be other factors that mean that they are a match. But there's just, I suppose what I'm saying is there's lots that go into it. It's not like one tool, as it were. But my area is around sexual compatibility.
I'd heard, this might be a myth, that the dinner parties, you watch the whole thing.
Yes, we do.
So it's not, so obviously we get the televised highlights, but you watch the whole thing from start to finish.
Yeah.
And is that the only time you've seen them that week? So you don't know anything that's happened in the lead up?
No, we don't know.
Get to see it there.
No. So, and this is often the thing, isn't it? So I think people, we get a little bit of slack sometimes in the media, because when it gets to the commitment ceremony, we're asking questions. Sometimes the public are like, well, why are you not going in harder on that person? And it's like, well, we don't see that much. So we see the dinner party and what goes on there. And then, and sometimes even that, you can sometimes miss some conversation, but, you know, we see as much as we can. And then the commitment ceremony is like therapy. So, you know, when couples come to my therapy space, like I'm listening to what they're saying, I'm working with what they're bringing to the space. I'm looking at not just the verbal communication, I'm also looking at a non-verbal communication with couples. So I don't just take everything they say, I'm looking at what their body language is also saying. But ultimately, I don't get to see what goes on in their bedroom. I don't get to see what the argument, you know, how that really played out. And it's no different from Married at First Sight.
Yeah.
We work with what's presented to us.
There's also that thing of overcoming, people can only go through any self-development, there's self-awareness there, can't they? So I think sometimes what people think they are, or how they think they're presenting themselves, it's actually totally different to what they actually are. Is there a difficulty in the commitment ceremony of kind of getting someone to like, here's the ugly mirror, and they're just not acknowledging that that was them?
Oh yeah, that happens all the time. Yeah, you know, but it's difficult for all of us, isn't it, to take feedback on and, you know, also as well, your defences are probably going to be quite high if you're sat on a couch in front of Paul, Mel and Charlene and all the other couples watching you as well. And if you also then acknowledge the fact that 2 million people are also probably watching you as well, because that's the reality, right? It's nerve-wracking and you will want to defend yourself. And so if Paul, Mel or myself are saying to someone, you know, you need to really, you know, think about your behavior and think about like how that impacts others, it might be that you are going to do your very best to defend yourself and be like, well, no, actually, I think this person is also to blame, you know, because why wouldn't you? We'd all probably try to defend ourselves. I think Paul, Mel and I, we try to build that rapport and that, that relationship with the couples and with them individually so that they know that we're on their side and we actually want them to do better. We want the relationships to work. Like, I know people don't always believe that, but we actually do. We want, you know, my ideal situation would be that all the 10, 12 couples work out. I mean, I don't know if that would make great TV, but I'd love for them all to work out. And that's why, you know, I'm often the one in tears when there's some sort of sad moment that's happened when, you know, someone doesn't like the other person and they break up. You know, that's hard to see because you can see how much they really want it.
We've just revealed in this conversation how big a fans we are of Married at First. We were playing it tough, and there's been something in the media quite recently, and I see things on TikTok and Instagram, and there's lots and lots of comments that people are falling into two parties, and I thought, who better to ask than a sex therapist? Have you heard the name Bonnie Blue?
I have indeed. Yeah.
Okay. So Bonnie Blue has famously slept with thousands of people in a day.
Yes.
there are two kind of trains of thought of disgusting and also she's a woman, she can do what she wants, X, Y, Z. What's your gut reaction? Where do you go with it?
So it's really interesting. So I put a post out about Bonnie Blue a few weeks ago. So I'm not sure if you guys have seen that on my Instagram, and that got so much engagement, so many comments. Interestingly, a lot of the women were saying that it's disgusting, and you know, she should know better, and her poor children if she has kids in the future, and who'd want to marry her and stuff like that. There was a lot of sort of shaming of her in terms of the decision that she's made. I think I'm a bit on the fence with it, in that for me, I try not to judge someone until I know them, or unless I've kind of dug a little bit deeper into like what's going on here. Because if the situation is one where she's had a very healthy childhood, healthy experiences in life, lots of love, and she just enjoys sex, she finds it pleasurable and fun, then you kind of think, well, why not? I think the bit that feels uncomfortable for me is the bit around her sort of targeting like this legally, barely legal. You know, I think I don't know why she would go after someone like that, why she'd really promote it. Like there's a bit of confusion for me around what that's about. Is it just so that people will talk about it? Because, you know, we're talking about it now. People are talking about it. So has that served the purpose for her? So I feel like there's lots of question marks around what's going on for her. Of course, the gut reaction of anyone is like shock, isn't it? Like, goodness me.
Yeah.
And I've watched some of her interviews. And although I've probably heard everything possible when it comes to sex, some of her reactions do shock me, if I'm honest. Like, it really does. And there's parts of me that feels quite sad about what I'm seeing. But as I said, I don't know her, so I don't know her story.
So following on from that, I'm probably going to ask for some advice. I've got a young son. Zach's got 4 kids. How do we as parents and as fathers, and I'm sure mothers listening as well, but how do we prepare our children for romance, sex? What the honest conversations we should be having with them as they grow, and at what ages?
Yeah, I think, well, it has to be age appropriate. So it's always difficult to sort of say when you should maybe introduce a conversation around sex. But I would say that when they're young, I'm talking about primary school age, I think it's important to normalize the world of sex and relationships. So for example, just being aware that if you're, I know, seeing 2 people kissing, that you're not saying, oh my gosh, you know, things like that, or like get a room, you know, those types of things. Or particularly like in terms of like, you know, if they sort of go into the world of being queer and things like that, that they're not hearing you make sort of off the cuff comments about a gay person or a lesbian person, because if that is then their experience, they won't feel like they can come to you. So I think things like that, you know, also things like nakedness as well. So you have to get the balance right between teach them the importance of privacy and that their body is private, but not in a way that's so shaming, like where it's like, cover yourself. Oh my gosh, like, what are you doing? No, no, no. Because that can also send a very different and difficult message. We know there are lots of adult women who, when they were younger and they started their period, their mums were like, oh my gosh, like, this is the worst. Like, don't tell your dad. Like, come here. Like, this is what you do with a sanitary towel. This, you know, and it was all kind of secret and it was like forbidden. And oh my gosh. And then a lot of them a lot of women that I work with have also said that they got a bit of a lecture from their mum around, like, now you can get pregnant, so be careful. And it was all very shame-based. So I think you just have to be careful about how, you know, like how you have conversations. Make sure you've got like an open forum that they can come to you. And also, even though they might feel a bit uncomfortable about the conversation, it is important to have the conversation about healthy relationships, about sex, and that they know they can come to you if they need to. Because I think for a lot of us, that privilege wasn't awarded to us. So we had to learn as we went along.
No, I'm with you. Let's finish on the book.
Yes.
Let's talk about the book. So
yeah.
If we go back to the very start, if this book was a doctor and someone picking it up was a patient, what symptoms do they need to have to make it worthwhile read?
Absolutely. So it would be someone who's confused around anything to do with sex. Maybe if they feel like they're in a bit of a rut in their relationship. And I think for single people, I feel like this is the toolkit to having the best sex and the best relationship ever.
Amazing. Okay. And is it the sort of book where it's you've got to read back to front to get your head around it? Or is it I can drop in, teach myself something, apply it? How would you summarize that?
I think it's best to start from chapter one, because the way that the book has been written is that you're kind of on a journey with it. So the first chapter talks about like your sexual history. So, you know, we spoke just now about sort of sex education and, you know, teaching children about sex. So it starts with understanding where this has all started for you. And what I mean by that is that for some people, they think, oh, there was nothing significant that happened when it came to sex when I was younger. And then you dig a little bit deeper and they're like, I do remember that I went into my uncle's wardrobe and there was a porn magazine that just dropped out and I didn't quite know what to do with that. But I kept going back and types of stories. But sometimes some of those porn magazines can send a very confusing message to a young child if there isn't a parent that they can go to or a teacher to answer their questions. So the first chapter kind of talks about your sexual history and where it all started. And there's lots of jokes in there about my own personal experiences with parents, or my mum in particular, who, you know, of course this is like the 80s as well, who would, like, if Home and Away or Neighbours was on, now obviously these are daytime shows. They're not even close to 9 p.m. You know, if they're kissing and really passionately kissing, my mum would turn the TV over, or comments will be made like, oh, goodness me, like things like that, you know. And that just sent a very confusing message, I think, around intimacy, like as if it was like wrong to do that. When I was young, I wasn't allowed to have a boyfriend. And then, you know, so any boy that you liked, it was all secret. Like me and my sister would talk about it, but you weren't allowed to have a boyfriend. It was like, you need to focus on your education. So the first chapter kind of deals with that, the importance of understanding where it's all come from. And then after that, there's lots of information there around sexual desire, around sex toys, around infidelity and the impact that that has on relationships, how to have the best sex ever, lots of tips around kind of like, sexual pleasure, like, you know, ways that you can enhance sexual pleasure. I talk about temperature play when it comes to like sex toys. So there are some sex toys that you can heat up. There are some sex toys that can be really cold. You can put them in the fridge or the freezer, and that creates a different sensation in your body. So there's lots of different tips in there. So I really do feel like all the DMs I get around sex and relationships, I say to them, go to the book. Your answer's in the book. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, Charlene, thank you so much for joining us. I've loved this conversation. I've taken so much away, and I can't wait to share it with my partner as well. I think she'll love it. If people want to find you, they want to find the book, how can they get in touch? Where should they follow you?
So I think if you're on Instagram, that's probably the best place to find me, because I'm very active on Instagram, which is Charlene Douglas Official. Just in case anyone tries to take Charlene Douglas, make sure the official was on there. But you can also go to my website, The Intimacy Coach UK. TheIntimacyCoachUK.com. And I always host in-person events as well. So I've got an event on Saturday, 24th of May. I don't know quite when this podcast will come out, whether that will be...
It'll probably... We should be saying it was a great event.
It was an amazing event. Wow. Gosh. Incredible.
Right. So I hosted a fantastic event on Saturday, 24th of May. And those types of events get everyone in the room where people are talking about sex and intimacy. There are sex toy brands. I'm there answering questions. It's always a fun day.
So, how often do you run those?
Every 2 months.
Every 2 months, okay. Yeah. So we'll try and line it up with
the next,
and then it'll
be around July.
There we go. Yeah. Well, amazing. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.